closer.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
I mean, did he turn up?
The Spectro Man showed up at my house when I was taking a nap before going to a show, and he offered me a great deal. And I said, sure, I'll switch to Spectro.
This feels like a parable.
And then Jesus parted the sea. No, that's Moses. But he offered me a great deal, and I was like, sure, great, get rid of AT&T. And then the stuff arrives, and it doesn't work. So the guy, luckily I had his number, and I said, hey, it's not working. What should I do? And he goes, well, I think you got the wrong equipment. So he shows up at my house on Saturday and says, okay, I got your equipment. Now I'm going to ask something of you. Would you come with me to the Spectrum store? Because they won't give me the new equipment. You can ride with me. And I said,
what?
So all of my stranger danger is immediately showing up. And I go, I'll follow you.
Also, your janky-ass business danger. Like, what the hell kind of a process is that for customer onboarding?
Yeah, weird as hell. Anyway, go to the Spectrum store, wait a long time, get new stuff, come back. And as my original suspicion was, stuff still doesn't work. So Cable Man showed up at my house late today, and finally it's working. But now that man who has my number is now calling and texting me relentlessly going, is everything okay? Does everything work? And I texted him back and I said, yeah, everything's fine, buddy. It's good. We don't need to talk anymore.
Go away. We're through.
The transaction is, it's as if I worked a private party and then kept calling the client. Go, everything all right? Everything good?
Is everyone really happy? Has anyone asked about it yet? That's so weird.
Just leave me alone and let me use my now high-speed internet.
It's actually hilarious how I gave Spectrum the finger and went to AT&T. For totally different reasons. Just because I had the weirdest experience because Spectrum, I signed up with them because it was the only way to get, back when it was Time Warner Cable and all that crap. And the internet was fine. But when I signed up, they put a typo in my name. I was Simon Coronan rather than Simon Coronel. That's all right, it happens. It's a letter. No big deal. I called up and got it changed. And then I started to notice over the next months and now years, gradually increasingly vast quantities of junk mail in my physical mailbox addressed to Simon Coronan from all kinds of companies.
It's amazing.
And
how
so
that
it's
works.
Very rare that like this time I actually have a definitive smoking gun that I know 100% it was Spectrum selling my data. Because if it just says Simon Coronan, you'd have no idea. But I know that's the typo that Spectrum got wrong when I signed up that has since been corrected. And now to this day, I'm still getting a whole bunch of shit each month from random-ass bullshit offers and crap and credit card companies saying, Mr. Coronan, would you be interested? So Spectrum can go get effed.
So I'm screwed is basically what you're telling
Probably,
me.
Probably, yeah.
Like, they already have my social
security
number. They already
have your stuff, yeah. But, and also then they did a whole bunch of like deceptive pricing bullshit, which is very common for most companies,
yeah.
I think. In America, at least, in your ultra-free capitalist market where companies can just do whatever the hell they want.
Exactly.
If they can get away with it.
Okay, we're going to edit this part out. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul. That's Simon Coronel.
Hey. What's up? Sorry, I was momentarily distracted.
We don't have anything super important to talk about. We're both kind of just living this Zen life right now, which is weird for the both of us.
Yeah, we're both in sort of down curves between periods of insanity. We're in our respective eyes of the storm.
I mean, I'm about to go on a ship for a week and then come back and then go out for 2 weeks, but then I'm done with ships till January, which I did strategically for my own sanity, but it's weird how like it is such a source of obviously income, but just like living comfort. It's okay, I don't have a choice, I have to do these.
Yeah.
But the anxiety that keeps showing up from having to travel so much is getting worse and worse.
What is the anxiety specifically about? Do you know, or is it generalized and non-specific?
It's changing in that like I literally feel like, to be completely honest, it feels as if I'm never going to see my wife and dogs again.
Right.
It's one of those things of, well, this could be it. When I've been traveling, essentially pretty regularly for the past 5-ish years, if not more. I don't know. I think just something about knowing I have to be gone for at least a week.
Yeah.
That's really, like we had a magician friend of ours who's a fan of the podcast. reach out, and I think he did like 9 weeks or something on a ship. And I may have mentioned this when this was many months ago, but he was just so thankful that kind of talking about this experience.
Yeah, he let him feel validated and realized it's not just him.
Yeah, so it's, I don't know, something in my head is changing, just perceiving it differently. And when, you know, once I get on the boat and I get my schedule, it's fine. And it's like, it's not the end of the world. It's not hard work. It's just the mental act of going, okay, I got to do this, I got to do that, I got to do this, just to do essentially 4 shows. It's a lot of mental taxation on me.
It's interesting. I mean, that sounds like that sense you described of part of your brain is thinking, this is it, I'm going away forever. Yeah. I'm never coming back. I mean, that's one of those things. I mean, there's so many ways that anyone's mind can get crosswired, right? You associate, like, say you were never coming back. It'd be the same, like you're leaving and you are coming back. But if you were leaving and never coming back, you'd be doing the same things, if that makes sense. So it's maybe your brain is like associating that somehow subconsciously.
I think so.
And that's clearly what's triggering that anxiety response, is some part of your subconscious thinks you aren't coming back.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a way to gradually convince it otherwise and go, it's cool, buddy. It's okay.
Yeah. It's weird how, like, for 1 second I'm, and it's the same, I was talking about this with, I did a corporate event with a bunch of magicians, and I was working with one magician. We were just talking about different anxiety medications, and she was trying something new, and it's just comforting to know that other people are in this spot too, because I forget how anxious I get before a show until it's like a couple hours before, and like the only thing I really want in the world is the show to be canceled. It's like, if that happens, oh, that's great. But then once you're up on stage, it's this, and I was listening to Conan O'Brien in an interview. He was on Fresh Air last week, and it was super great. If you haven't listened to it, check it out. He just talked about his anxieties and then being on stage and how it all goes away. Mm. It's the only moment that all fades away. You're not thinking about anything else. And when I heard him say that, it was the first time I had ever consciously put that together of like, and I had just got done doing I was at Comedy Magic Club. I did a 10-minute set. And I was just thinking back to the set I had just done. And I'm like, oh, I wasn't thinking about I wasn't thinking about the things I had to do at home. I wasn't thinking about the tasks, the home things. It was insane. But yeah, I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of things like that in life that are powerfully meditative, in the sense that most meditation, whatever you define the goal to be, is to reach this state of sort of empty-headedness, of, you know, emptiness, of nothingness, of freedom from whatever intrusive thoughts or whatever. And there are a lot of things that put you there. And for different people, it varies. Like for me, one of the things that gets it there, if I'm playing a video game that's really got me, that's a really good one, that I'm just completely absorbed and there's no other thoughts in my normally hyperactive brain.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons why I freaking love them. That's why I tend to like have a mild addictive tendency with them, because it's such a glorious respite from all the thoughts and all the hyperanalysis. And being on stage is one of those things, usually, that puts you so completely in the moment that there is no room for even any other thought out there.
Yeah. Sorry, my dog.
Which can be a beautiful, glorious thing.
Pause. Hold it. I had a thought. Pause.
Pause that thought while we deal with dogs.
My dog has lost his hearing, so he stopped whining at this door, and now he's whining at the door where there are no people. I've realized he can only hear certain frequencies. So if we, there we go. Well, he just looked. That's why he saw that. Come here, little one. So what's?
This reminds me a little bit of the infamous over episode where we struggled with circumstances.
Where it's terrible. Yeah, the circumstances now are not geographic locations.
The gap between sort of the reality of the situation and the imaginary state of a fully professional podcasting operation.
A wiener dog that wants all the attention in the world. Yeah. So.
Well, this is also,
this last.
This is one of those interesting things, given that you are very much sort of director of this podcast. And so it's like when I'm doing a show, when any of us are doing a show, we're doing the show, but also thinking about the edits we're going to make for the next time we do the show, during the show. And the audience has no awareness of that. They can only experience and usually imagine the show they're seeing, whereas we're imagining that and the next show and the changes and what it could have been. And I know that right now you are in your mind doing something that I can't, which is sort of imagining which bits are getting cut out. And I'm aware that you will have this mental track going on in parallel to the mental track I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now find myself in a situation like this, dealing with dogs, imagining what is happening in Nick's mental edit track going on right now. Are we keeping this in because it's funny and interesting? Is this just, no, this is getting cut?
I don't know. I always make these edit notes and then I go back and I've spent an hour editing the podcast for various things or just trying to make it sound better. And then I get to a point of, well, it's fine. Like there was a thing in the last episode where I think you made a comment and then we knocked over the microphone and said, oh, that's going out. And I left it in because it wasn't super loud. Yeah. And also it was really funny.
Yeah.
So I don't know. There are... the editor in my brain has kind of changed as the years have gone by. But I don't know. What were we talking about? Anxieties and then being on stage? Something like that.
The meditativeness of being on stage.
The video game thing. It really is like one of those moments of Zen where you are able to get into that meditative state.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to give him a treat. Hang on.
All right, no worries.
This will get annoying really quickly.
So meanwhile, welcome to One Magician, One Mic.
Simon, you can...
Temporarily featuring me, Simon Coronel, and not Nick.
You can talk about that venture capitalist, right?
Yeah, well, I need to explain that to you. All right, Nick's gone. It's just us. This actually feels really weird. Hey there, listeners. This is Simon. It's just us. This is actually fascinating. I've never been in this situation before and suddenly feel intensely self-conscious. Because now I'm talking directly to you rather than to my buddy Nick, who I know really well. Whereas now I'm talking to a microphone, talking ostensibly to you, people whom I mostly don't know. Man, this is super weird. Nick, come back!
I don't even know. Like, we were talking... We went I mean, to get
it,
some...
it got pretty existential there. I'm not going to lie. It's on brand.
I'm excited to go back and listen to it now. that stayed in.
That was... You never know. Again, it's that great Douglas Adams quote where being asked about where he gets his ideas, and he said that in his experience, the thing you end up creating, the book, the film, the whatever, is the byproduct of your experience, your failure to create what you intended to. Whatever you set out to create,
that's pretty great,
is definitely not exactly, it might be very similar, but it will never be exactly what you meant to create in the first place. And sometimes it'll be very different. And he was saying all his books, everything he's ever done has been completely different to what he actually aimed at in the first place.
Yeah.
And so he can't really tell you where he got the idea because that wasn't his idea. So he just tried to create something, ended up with something else that seemed pretty good and people liked it. So, all right, we'll go with that.
I think that, that's incredibly true because if I'm looking back at every piece of show or whatever project we've worked on, that does ring true because you come up with an initial idea and then it changes 3,000 different ways. Yeah. And then the original idea does become a sort of failure.
Yeah. And I think I first read that Douglas Adams quote a couple of decades ago, probably. And it just stuck with me so powerfully. And I think that's fine. It's one of those things that's good and that's right and that's healthy because that is the only way things go. Like that is, except for the unbelievably rare, bizarre situations where you exactly realize your vision. But that's such a rare thing to barely even be worth thinking about. Mm-hmm. So it's like, get out there and try and do things that will be good eventually in some way and be very, not just willing, but actively leaning into changing and flexing and adapting and, reacting to the cheese moving on you and so on.
Mm-hmm. I got to do this part because I was just talking to our pal Taylor Hughes and he's like, you got to do Simon Says. And we have forgotten. I've forgotten.
Oh, shit. What was that? This rings a bell. This was when we were in the car in Vacaville, right?
So Simon Says is this brilliant idea he came up with where I have to find a quote that sounds... It's either something you said or something somebody else said. And you have to decide if you are the one that said it. So now time to play Simon Says. Insert... cheesy game show music here.
Oh, God.
Okay, this is what I found while you're taking a pee-pee.
All right.
It's, you don't need to be likable, but you do need to be engaging. Was that you or someone else?
Crap. That might be me paraphrasing someone else, because that makes me think of a thing. I can't remember who observed this, but there's this thing about likability. You've got to be likable, And someone pointed out and used Max Maven as an example.
Ding, 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 ding. He wins.
Yeah.
Someone
who's not instantly likable, but is interesting and engaging on stage.
Existential curmudgeons. I want to say this is... January 1st, 2018. Yeah. I think I have it right here.
Openness to feedback. Being too... meet and befriend.
Okay, no, that's just me talking. But you... it was from that episode.
What was the context? I can't remember now.
I don't even know.
All right.
It was probably the same shit we talk about.
Was I quoting someone else?
You were. You were saying this is what Max Maven said.
That's what Max Maven said.
That's why I figured it would trick you. Because you said it, but it wasn't your thought.
Okay.
Well done, Taylor Views. Well done.
That's a fun idea.
I need to not forget to do this. I have it written down.
Interesting. Listeners, let us know if you enjoyed the inaugural game of Simon Says.
My favorite, we got a bunch of great 5-star reviews, but my favorite one, I can't remember if I've mentioned this before, is I think he gave us 4 stars.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't like the intro music.
That's amazing.
Just sad. Hey. My friend wrote the intro music and I thought, I like it. That's why I keep it.
I mean, it's that thing that you'll never please everybody. You can just sort of shift your bell curve as far as you can.
Yeah.
It's something Eugene Berger was fond of saying. Here we go, planning ahead for next year's episode of Simon. It was, again, like Eugene Berger quoting someone else. So it's me quoting a guy, quoting someone else, who knows. But not everyone likes the Beatles.
Yeah.
Right? Doesn't matter how beloved or universally quoted. Not everyone likes Pixar movies. Right? Not everything is liked by everybody, even the most loved thing.
And those people are idiots.
But they might.
It's weird how in my
they might give you a dollar on Patreon.
It's funny. It's weird in my brain. I immediately shut those people out. But then you have to realize that you have to look at it going, not everybody.
Mm.
It's like I did a ship, my last Disney ship. I'm happy to admit this. I don't care.
Mm.
I did 4 shows in the main theater, so that's about 4,000 people that saw my show. And my agent had a meeting with the booker, and he's like, and the booker goes, well, he got 4 negative reviews.
Mm.
And to me, I'm like, that's great.
Out of how many people?
I did the math, about 4,000 people probably saw my show.
Wow.
Because the theater seats about 1,000, and you do 2 a night, and I did 4.
Mm.
So 4 people felt it necessary to write in that they didn't like my show.
Yeah.
And of course, Disney being Disney goes, well, clearly he's not a favorite and whatever, that's fine. And I'm probably screwing myself over for future Disney contracts. But I think it's important to put out there of just knowing that not everybody is going to like you, and that's okay.
Well, that gets in interesting territory, thinking about that four negative reviews out of 4,000.
Yeah.
That, because there's several different ways to look at that. One is that's a 0.1% negative review. Mm-hmm. But then, and this is sort of my analyst hat, thinking back to business consulting years, and going, all right, well, if you're trying to measure performance, Disney's goal is make money. One of the ways they make money is by selling tickets to cruises.
Yeah.
How do they sell those tickets? By making the experience good, blah, blah, blah. And you go down the tree until eventually it's like, right, hire magicians that are good. Okay. Then how do you measure that? How do you measure which? Because eventually Disney or any company is going to basically hire the magicians that will help them make money the most effectively.
Sure.
Think KPIs, key performance indicators, yada, yada, consultant theory. And eventually, so you can either go ratio of positive, how many positive reviews, because getting a review, not knowing the exact process, if 4 people felt the urge to go and write something down, that means there were more than that were thinking it but didn't care enough.
Yeah, for sure.
But then do you know how many good reviews, how many people liked it so much they wrote a review? But then there's that different thing that it won't be the same thing. People who liked it as much as someone who disliked it, there will be a bias one way or the other. People who liked it are less likely to write a positive review than people who disliked it are more likely to say they disliked it.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also how many negative reviews did the other performers get? What's average? Are you graded on a curve versus graded on an absolute percentage scale? I have no idea. I just always think about that stuff.
Oh, none of it makes sense.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you that... I mean, and I am not taking full responsibility of, I didn't do a good enough job. That's just how it is.
Well, but based on their arbitrary standards, right?
Exactly.
What those tastes are.
And those arbitrary standards, work in favor of other performers who kill it on there. Yeah. And then those same performers don't kill it on other either ships or types of performance locations or whatnot. So it's the standards are essentially meaningless, but it's the way they rate. It's their system, and that's what they're sticking to, and how it goes.
And it's like everything, because, not everything appeals to everyone. Something that's terrible in one environment will be great in another, et cetera, et cetera.
And you see that, especially at the castle, where you see people just destroy.
Mm.
But for me, I would I would love to see people that destroyed the castle then thrown into a corporate event with ballroom tables and or a room where nobody knew was expecting a show. Okay, how do they handle that?
Environments. Mm-hmm. There's also that thing that I think about a lot that I first heard about in terms of sporting success, which is so not my area at all. I'm a very unsporty person. And this was back when Tiger Woods was first carving up the golf scene. So 15, 20, I mean, a long time ago. Back before all the other Tiger Woods stuff went down. And everyone was just marveling at this guy. My God, he's so good. Mm-hmm. And someone pointed out, again, I may be wrong here. This is very secondhand information. I'm not a sporting or golf expert. The big thing about Tiger was not so much his peak performance, which was very good, but it was his consistency. It was that he was, like, rather than being sometimes A plus and sometimes C minus, being like always A and then occasionally A plus and occasionally B plus, but like very high consistent performance is usually much more valuable in most areas in life than occasional transcendently brilliant performance and like then sometimes the opposite. So being consistent rather than, and that's not always true. There are situations that the opposite's true, but it's something I think about a lot, is trying to work on upraising sort of my average case in every kind of situation in life rather than sort of just thinking about where. Yeah, but okay, now I'm going to rebut myself, which is like, sometimes that's not true. It's like lean into your strengths and find the things you could. It's better to be like brilliant at something and average at everything else than just really good at everything. I don't know. Don't take any of that as life advice.
Well, none of, we're just, as clearly with the past Simon Says reference, we're all just making this up, you know. People have been listening for way too long.
But the, I mean, what's interesting, again, looking at, speaking of creating the side effect of your failure of the original intent, look at this podcast. This is not what you meant this to be when you started it, but this is what it seems to have ended up being because for whatever reason or reasons people were responding to it. Mm-hmm. And we know from having spoke to a lot of them, the consistent thing of like, okay, why? One thing that does keep coming up is the like honesty and sincerity and realness of it.
Well, it's interesting. We talked about this after we finished talking with Robert, that I turned the mic off and I brought up how the first episode I did with the first gentleman, Mark Tolan, we just basically ripped apart these magicians that we saw. And I didn't realize until months later when magicians I knew really well came up and said, hey, that really hurt my feelings the way you talked about my friend. And it was the first time I realized, oh, A, people are listening to this, and B, like what you say has power.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why we both have kind of
roll out.
The problem with him being deaf is he can't hear me
yell. He can't actually hear the yell. Right now, I'm in the middle of watching Better Call Saul. I think I just finished season two. And this is reminding me of that sort of thing of a person, you know, him like, and this is not a spoiler because it's in like the first episode, him like living and working in this really crappy, dingy office, but trying to seem like he's a professional, running a professional law practice. This feels like this. We're just in this room with squealing dogs and a mobile mic trying to pretend to be a, we're not even pretending to be a serious professional podcasting.
No, I stopped pretending a long time ago.
Yeah, it's much better that way. But also think about, I was watching like Mark Cuban answering people's questions on Twitter, like video thing where he read out the answers live. And one thing that came up was that when, you know, when he was starting, I think this is a very common knowledge in that field, that he was sort of sharing an sleeping on the floor of an apartment, 3-bedroom apartment shared with 6 other guys, just to save costs and keep the expenses low,
which
to keep working on stuff.
So I am completely blank. We know he was like a Jack. We used him in Jackbox all the time. But Mark Cuban is from,
famous for Shark Tank.
Thank you.
That's Shark Tank. Where most, and he's like just a venture capitalist, gazillionaire now. Mm-hmm. With many businesses and companies.
And then this goes into this venture capitalist story you were telling me on our coffee run.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't get through the whole thing.
This is the thing, as we got coffee earlier and went, do we have anything to talk about this week, fortnight?
No, we never do.
Are we fortnightly or monthly now?
Depends. I think we're still doing twice a month, even though in my head I think I verbally said we're going down to once a month, but this is still twice a month.
Cool. Well, it's good. Good to keep up to date on.
I can't even keep track of how many times I want to do this a month.
So I was thinking this came up in conversation because, and again, it's entirely possible I've already told this to you or indeed said this on the podcast. I can't even remember. Let me know, Nick or listeners, if that's the case. But this was a noteworthy. It's a short article that I'm just going to read because it's only a couple of hundred words by a guy called Derek Sivers, who is a mostly online entrepreneur now. I think venture capitalist guy, smart businessy guy. made a bunch of money being clever and productive. And this was sent to me by Max Temkin, who I have to credit, one of the creators of Cards Against Humanity, who I've been talking to for various reasons. And he sent this forwarded this as the thing that really influenced him, and he thought he really agreed with. And out of everything I've read, probably in the last couple of years, this is the single thing that has the most direct, significant impact on the way I approach everything in life now. Like, this really changed the way I looked at and thought about and act upon a lot of things. So I will now slightly paraphrase. This isn't word for word, but it's basically the article by Derek Sivers. Titled, Ideas Are Just a Multiplier of Execution. It's so funny when I hear people being so protective of ideas. People who want me to sign an NDA just to tell me the simplest idea. To me, ideas are worth nothing unless executed. They are just a multiplier. Execution is worth millions. For example, awful idea equals -1. Weak idea equals 1. So-so idea, 5. Good idea, 10. Great idea, 15. Brilliant idea, 20. Now, no execution is worth $0. Weak execution, $1,000. So-so execution, 10,000. Good, 100,000. Great, 1,000,000. Brilliant execution is worth $10 million. To make a business, you need to multiply the two. The most brilliant idea with no execution is worth $0. The most brilliant idea takes great execution to be worth $20 million. That's why I don't want to hear people's ideas. I'm not interested until I see their execution. And that really deeply affected me in what I think is a very positive way. Because I think, like most people, I had throughout most of my life tended to overvalue ideas, both my own and other people's. You know, thinking, oh, this is a brilliant idea. This could be the next big thing. And realizing it's not that that's worthless, but it only has value as a multiplier of execution, of the get it done. And what it immediately made me think in terms of thinking about business ideas, how am I going to make $1 million? How am I going to make money? Let's take the most basic ass, non-interesting idea. Here's my idea. Start a coffee cart. Set up a coffee cart outside an office building, sell coffee to business people. That's not a very interesting idea. But if you executed that really well.
Keep going.
God, yeah. Once again, it is fascinating how awkward this feels. I have no background in sort of solo. This is why I have nothing on my YouTube channel except for occasional performance clips. Because just talking to a microphone or talking to a video camera just feels so weird and uncomfortable and fake, artificial. I don't know. I guess I'm only used to talking to actual people rather than a theoretical idea. I mean, I know you're actual people, whoever's listening, but I don't know who you are or what you look like or what you think about. So it's hard to... It's actually it, isn't it? It's the fact that ideally everything you're saying to an audience, whether it's one person you're talking to or a whole crowd you're talking to, is ideally at least in some way unique for that audience. I'm hanging out with the listeners here, Nick. It's getting real.
Have you got any calls?
Like getting into some stuff. I was just realizing that I was examining why it felt so awkward for me to be talking to the listeners via the microphone on my own. And it's because I realized that ideally everything you ever say to an audience, be it one person, hey Nick, you're my audience, I'm talking to you as a human being, or to a big crowd, is at least said to that audience. You know who they are. Like, if I was talking to you, I wouldn't talk about, like, technical programming jargon because I know you wouldn't get that. You know, you're going to craft the message to the person you're actually speaking to. And with, let's say, it's a crowd, an audience, you at least know who they are. You know what venue they're in. You have some kind of shared context. Whereas here, on my own, talking to the microphone and whoever's listening, I really know almost nothing about who they are. Like, I know who a few of them are. You know, a few of them are friends. But, like, the audience as a whole, however many hundred people it is that listen to this, I suddenly felt like literally and figuratively blind. And so I'm like, I don't know who I'm talking to now. So I don't know how to talk. I don't know what to say. Oh, I don't know who they really are. And I didn't realize that.
You just discovered I have kind of a baseline default if I don't know the demographics of the audience.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I was just thinking about it right then. I've never before 2 minutes ago, I think ever in my life, been in a situation where I'm talking to an audience that I really don't know anything about or can't really get a vibe for, at least visually or conceptually. Or, you know, if I was told, hey, you're talking to 60 accounting people from Ernst & Young, at least then I'd be like, hey, everyone from Ernst & Young, how you all doing? Now, you don't know much about magic. You know, I would have something to anchor on, sure. But that was super weird. I learned something today.
We learned about your... See, that my whiny dog taught you about
yourself. See, you never know. Wisdom can be, knowledge, whatever, can be found in the most unexpected situations.
But you got halfway through that, and then I forget where.
Oh, yeah. So I was thinking about the coffee cart. So your idea is, I'll make a coffee cart. You wouldn't call that a great idea. That's like, it's a neutral idea. But I've seen coffee carts that are making, you know, six-figure incomes a year because they're really well done. They're organized. They're there on time. The coffee's good. The customer service is great. You have a low
overhead cost, too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not a... I just call that like a so-so idea, probably.
Sure.
I don't know. But that's the point. The idea doesn't need to be great to make a very successful, effective business or whatever, whether it's not a business, whether it's a humanitarian thing. You don't need brilliant... Brilliant ideas are definitely good, but they multiply the execution. They don't make the thing great. And that really, ever since then, that has just been in my head with nearly everything in life. And for about a year now, 8 months, whatever, since I first read that, I've really been thinking in everything I do about focusing on becoming a better executor rather than sort of dwelling on my ideas. Oh, this is a great idea. And I think that's so valuable because think about it, every project wants someone who's great at execution, whatever that means. Building the thing, doing the thing, promoting the thing, repairing the thing, whatever it is, getting the shit done. And I would personally say that in part of execution is also just the luck, right? Right place, right time. There's a market for it. But that's also part of the idea to a degree.
I think for me, I'm the opposite where I will execute too quickly. Mm. I'll jump on an idea before it's really ready.
Yeah.
But that's not, that in general has served me well. Mm. So it's not a bad thing because I know there's so many people, I mean, you still... you know, work hard and execute and, you know, get things done. But there are so many people I know that are brilliant, but don't take the step to get things done. And so I've always kind of looked at that and gone, oh, I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to, you know, jump on the opportunity.
Yeah.
When realistically it's so easy to jump on something before it's ready to fly.
Well, it reminded me a lot of that thing in child psychology that is now thankfully becoming more and more widely known of that thing where research studies found very consistently that if you praise children for being smart, say a kid writes a good essay, and if you praise them going, oh, that's great, you are so smart. Yeah. And they go, oh, cool, I'm smart. That basically sets them up for failure in life because they are taking pleasure in a thing they had no control of. Smartness is not a thing you can really plan to have. You've either got it or you don't. There's, you know, there's degrees, yes, you can train yourself, but generally, oh, you're so smart is an innate gift. Versus if you praise them for, oh, well done, you worked so hard on that. Good for you. You stuck at it. You did the thing.
Yeah.
Basically, praise them for their efforts, not their intelligence. Praise them for things they have control over and can work to improve rather than things they can't really do much about. Because then they get in that feedback loop of, yeah, I should work hard. I should keep at it. I should be disciplined and diligent. Because those things set you up for success.
Yeah.
Similarly, for myself, ever since reading that Derek Sivers thing, I found myself kind of internally trying to get myself into a loop of praising myself when I execute well, not for when I have a good idea. Because, again, ideas are not worthless, but they are worth far. I'd rather be a person who's great at executing across the board than a person who has great ideas. Because the former is always useful. The latter is sometimes useful, but often useless.
Yeah, because I in high school or even in grade school, I remember always kind of being jealous of people that didn't really have to do the work. We're just kind of naturally smart. But then I realized there are downfalls to that too. You don't realize that what effort is needed to be done to succeed later in life. So I'm glad I was always kind of a middle of the road student who had to work very hard to get A's and B's. Yeah. Like I couldn't just coast like friends. And then I was also glad where, you know, I knew many people that really struggled but didn't want to put the work in to get to where was needed to be to be a C or a B student.
Yeah.
And I mean, grades are certainly arbitrary, but it does show, you know, the amount of effort that you are putting into something, I think. Massively. Whether or not the grading scale is always correct, it still shows that, you know, just kind of who you are effort-wise as a person.
Yeah. And so that that piece has really affected the way I approach most things in, I think, a really positive way. It's not like I was lazy before, but I've realized I've become even more disciplined and diligent and focused on execute, make the thing great. And within the realm of quote-unquote execution, there are also thousands of little ideas. For example, making a voting website for a live Magic Smackdown show. okay, the execution is make the thing, make it exist in the world. And within that, there's lots of micro ideas like, okay, what's the background color? What's the layout? What scripting language do we use? How, like, there's a thousand tiny little ideas in it. And there's obviously a blurry definition between those different things. But the general concept, I think, really holds up of execute. Get better, train yourself over time very slowly to be better at making things happen in the world, executing.
I'm agreeing with you 100%, but I'm also thinking back to another thing Taylor Hughes told me of. He goes, yeah, there's a part where Simon will just go on a long, long discussion rant about something. Not rant, just into detail. You were just talking about the colors of the buttons. And he's like, my favorite part is when Nick doesn't know what to say and goes, all right. And that wasn't one of those moments, but that sparked my memory.
Oh, that's funny.
Very funny. We've been on the air so long that people know all of our little idiosyncrasies. That's pretty fascinating.
It is. That's one of those weird things, isn't it? Where most people know you better than you know yourself because it's hard to see a thing from inside it.
Yeah. And I don't want to get to the point. There are podcasts that I've been listening to for years and years, like a decade. I've listened to a couple podcasts, no joke. And they will complain about people's responses online. What did you talk about this? What did that? And I'm just like, I don't know. I almost kind of, you should feel honored that they know you so well.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's creepy in a way.
Gives enough of a damn to say, even pay attention to your shit. Yeah,
for sure.
do we talk about that? Something I do feel very self-conscious about on this podcast is my go-to glib phrase is I have many weaknesses, but being unaware of my weaknesses is not one of those weaknesses. I'm very aware of many of my... And I strive to account for them and improve them. But like, I know that
being unaware of your weaknesses, is that what you said?
Not being aware of my weaknesses is not one of my weaknesses. Mm. It's like a multi... There's several negatives in there for artistic effect.
Yeah, this is a recurring thing. A theme on this podcast is knowing what your strengths are and knowing what your weaknesses are and then... Okay, how do you make yourself a better human? Yeah. Like in my case, it's anxiety. I'm struggling with traveling anxiety. I'm struggling with, if I were to tell myself 5 years ago, hey, you're going to be working cruise ships regularly, but you're going to get really anxious about it and really sad that you have to leave, I would go, stop being a wuss. But then you're actually, in these situations, and it's funny, the phrase, the grass is greener, is so much truer the older I get.
Oh, yeah.
You just... And especially seeing, I don't want to bring up social media, but seeing people post things and go, oh wow, why am I not doing that? And then you're in a situation where you're without going into any details, we're working on something that we hope turns into something, but now all of these new sets of challenges that we didn't even really think about are coming our way. And it is fascinating to, one door opens, another one opens, and then another one opens. It's weird how things always seem to get a little bit more complicated and seem easier from a distance until you're actually engulfed in it yourself.
Yeah. And on a good day these days, even when I'm annoyed or unhappy or upset or struggling or whatever, I do frequently think back to my life 10 years ago where I was so much more unhappy and in such a worse overall situation in so many ways and go, no, you know what? And say, this super secret thing, let's vague cast it, this secret thing that eventually we'll be able to talk about, we're working on. Say that all fails. Say it doesn't work out at all. It falls in a heap. Mm-hmm. We're still no worse off than we were before.
Yeah.
And I keep, and it's a very common sort of mindfulness sort of technique to remind yourself that don't let your baseline of expectation get raised too far.
Yeah. And that's what's so great about having been in this for such a long time is nothing really excites me anymore. Mm. But that sounds so depressing and it's not. It's a great thing.
Yeah.
Because I know that it will most likely disappoint me in some way. Because I am an overly critical person who judges way too much. Mm. But I will poke holes in things, but now I have the ability to know that I poke holes in things. It's like I did this corporate event on Wednesday for the third time in a row. And the year before, the client's like, hey, we want you to break up the show into three different sets during dinner, which is you know, the worst possible thing you can do.
Yeah.
So this year I walk in going, oh, that's not happening again. And I talk to the guy, hey, buddy, how's it going? Good to see you. We're all set up, ready for the show. And he goes, great. Can you break up the show into four sets this year? And I've been in this long enough to know that this is how I not be a dick in this situation.
Yeah.
Like, the thing I wanted to do to go was, do you not remember what happened last year when people got up during the third set and were literally leaving to eat dessert? Yeah. But I didn't. I brought it around. I said, no, this is what's going to happen. This is how we're going to make this work. And, yeah.
There's something I...
God.
Hey, puppy dog.
Rollo!
How are you doing? You're struggling.
Okay.
I can't remember if someone told me this or I realized this. Who knows? This is so far back. But basically, you very, very rarely, if ever, have anything to gain by letting someone know of your disdain for them.
Yeah.
It's very rarely, possibly never, in your own interest to do that. It feels good. Much like eating a whole box of Oreos feels good, but it's bad for you.
It puts
you in a worse situation.
I've realized it because I'm somebody who used to snap rapidly and would express what I'm thinking right now. And then you realize, oh, I got to sit in this.
Yeah.
I have to sit. And that happened last night. Now, I didn't do it, but I was with some family or at an event. And there were some very loud talking people behind us at this concert at the Hollywood Bowl. And this goes on for 30 minutes, and a relative just eventually, you know, lets go and goes, excuse me, did you come here to have a conversation, or are you going to listen to the show? And he was absolutely correct. These people, it sounded like they were three rows behind us, and they sounded like they were in the box with us.
Yeah.
Because that's the way the bowl set up, in little cubes. And I'm like, yeah, go for it. All right, he's right. He's telling them how it is. And then I realized, oh, we still have another hour of this show. And we have to sit with this awkwardness now. And it ended up being fine. There wasn't an argument or anything like that.
Well, that's one of the things where I would call that an exception, because that is, I think that's a different thing. That's where the goal is get these people to stop talking. And it sounds like he achieved that goal. So that was the right action. As opposed to sort of telling someone off, even that, like, say, as you left.
Sure.
That would not be a useful thing to do. I would achieve nothing. Although that may potentially make them reconsider next time and help someone else. That might be paying it forward. But I remember thinking in so many situations in life when dealing with something, with annoyance or frustration or the temptation to lash out, is stop, breathe, and think, okay, what is my objective here?
Yeah.
Generally, what am I trying to achieve here? What do I want the outcome to be? If it's a gig, you want the gig to go well and to get paid. That's the primary objective. That's why you're there. Now, also, I realize I'd like to live in a world based on reason and compassion where people are smart and think about it. You can't have that. That is not an achievable objective.
I love the George Costanza line of, we live in a society.
Is that George Costanza?
It is. He's always a dick, but then when people are a dick to him, that's his response.
Is that where that originates? I've seen that.
I don't know if it originated in Seinfeld, but that's where what it made it popular for me.
I never knew that. I always wondered.
But we were flying out last week, and something was happening. It was like 6 in the morning. And an awkward set of situations, and we were sitting next to each other just kind of observing this. And then I heard this on another podcast the week before of, you know, if you're not happy on the plane, you're not going to be happy in Hawaii. And it's blown my mind.
Yeah.
It's maybe the best advice I've ever heard, and it's been so helpful because it's correct. It's like, how are you going to, if you can't be happy in this moment of chaos, why is sitting on a beach going to be any different?
Yeah.
I guess that's what we're told. We're told if you're in this destination, your state of mind will be different.
Yeah.
But that's...
I mean, there's some truth to it, but like you'll find a way to be frustrated in Hawaii because not everything will be perfect anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's the point.
No situation will ever be perfect. There'll always be annoyances and micro irritations and things like that. And if... Yeah, I mean, holy crap, it's been 2013, 2014, so it's been 5 years for me since I was in a bad enough place in life that I went, all right, I'm going to go see some actual serious, like an actual psychiatrist, rather than just psychologist or therapist. I'm going to some fucking serious medical professional to like talk about medications or whatever. And that happened, and that sort of went on its own little plot arc that is not relevant today. But, hey, puppy. The also saw a therapist who specialized in like meditation / mindfulness.
Mm.
And this was that guy who sort of had studied both sort of the Eastern / mystical sort of approach to meditation and sort of the Western / scientific approach to, you know, mindfulness, the two being largely but not completely the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of said, all right, this is the process, this is what you do, and just broke it down in a really demystified kind of pragmatic way that appealed to my engineer brain. I went, all right, I'll try it. And tried it for months and months and didn't seem to be doing anything. But he said it takes a long time. And that was 5 years ago. And holy crap, now I can see the difference it's made.
Mm-hmm.
But over kind of like a years long arc of slowly flexing that internal thought control muscle, like choosing what thoughts you allow into your head and getting better at having control over your own internal dialogue.
What's so funny is you're talking about this moment of meditation and like practice in your life. And I'm literally going through that right now with Rolo of like, how do I react to this dog that is whining so much?
Yeah.
And like my objective is just to record a podcast, but his objective is treats and attention.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a great example, right? Because right now we want to record a podcast that is of high quality to keep delightful listeners who we value. I don't know if
we've ever had high quality.
We genuinely value a great deal because it makes this worth doing.
The sad part is his bed is literally right next to you and he is going everywhere except sitting in his bed relaxing.
And we are struggling to achieve this goal due to this dog who has his own goals in life. And that sort of thing about going, there is the chance of intrusive thoughts of anger or frustration or annoyance or whatever. And kind of, but being now better at going, no, I choose not to let those thoughts enter. I'm in control of that. Those are understandable thoughts, but I'm going, no, we're not going with that.
Mm.
We're just going to keep going on with the thing and understand that the primary objective is not possible right now, at least not without, you know, moving the dog somewhere far away that he'd be really unhappy about. And we don't want to do that because that wouldn't be cool.
Mm-hmm.
So going, yeah, all right, we're going to compromise. And destroying your... like your coffee cup or whatever, going after your latte.
No, it's exactly. It's okay. How do we? How's the situation remedied? Is it possible to remedy situation?
And basically,
right now?
Going what it's always that again. This is something I know we've talked about. It's just what's the best we can achieve in the time we have, given the resources that are available and the possibilities there are. And right now, that given that we are not willing to be cruel to a dog, which I think is a good healthy thing, we are going to do the best job we can. And that will be whatever it ends up being. And maybe, like Douglas Adams, it'll be something great or not. I guess we'll find out.
And on that note, hey, puppy, before Rolo freaks out even more. Hey, everybody, thanks for listening. If you like podcasts with dogs on them, feel free to contribute to our Patreon $1 a month or so. We have a bunch of Patreon subscribers now. We really appreciate it. Yeah, we would like to keep the goal going up, but it's a good number of people. I think you can see it on the Patreon page.
I'll check it out.
Give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. And we have a...
And be kind to dogs.
Be kind to dogs.
And all animals.
And if you're anywhere near New Mexico, we have a show in December, a magic show down there. December 7th? And I don't have the casino.
Let me check. I can look it up.
I have the casino somewhere. That.
That's going to be fun. I'm looking forward
to it. We're doing it with our pal Scott Pepper. He will be our third in that one.
And we'll be happy on the we'll be happy on the plane to it.
Theoretically happy on the plane.
Oh,
it is
the 6th and Friday the 6th and Saturday the 7th of December.
Santa Ana Star Casino in Santa Ana, New Mexico. I don't know. There are tickets. There's a show on Saturday. There's a VIP show on Friday. If you're a VIP of that casino, go there.
So probably just the Saturday.
Yeah, realistically, Saturday, December 7th.
A couple of hundred K in the lead up.
Which is totally realistic, too. All right, have a good one, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemike.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs, @twomagiciansonemike. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.